Welcome back to the High Tech Forum podcast. I'm your host, Richard Bennett. And today I'm talking with Shane Tews, who's in Washington. Hello, Shane.
Hey, Richard. How are you?
Pretty good. I went to a congressional hearing in Boulder, Colorado this morning.
They came to visit you? That's unusual.
I mean, I was really pleased, you know, because the three times I've testified, I had to go to Washington to do it. But yeah, the antitrust subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee had a field hearing on platform power.
Yes, that's a big topic these days, and data portability.
It was kind of good timing because the four witnesses were the CEO of Sonos and the CEO of a company called PopSockets, which makes little phone accessories.
These are the things you put on the back of your phone so you can hold on to it.
Yeah, they're kind of like those, like I have this little elastic band on mine and they do like that.
I have a feeling you probably made yours. I could see you doing a DIY.
I modified it. That's what I...
I'm sure you did.
Yeah, I bought one and put it on the bandsaw to trim it down a little bit. But the one I have looks interesting, so I ordered one during the hearing.
Nice.
And then there's a guy from a company called Basecamp that makes project management software for smartphones. And a lady representing Tile, the company that makes those little kind of key fob things that you can...
So when you lose stuff, you can find it again?
Yeah, and she had a very interesting statistic. She said the average person spends 365 days of their life looking for stuff they lost.
So every day I'm looking for something?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, whenever I try to
walk in the room and I forget why I'm there.
that will become more frequent.
So how was the testimony?
Well, it was kind of a mixed bag. I mean, there are a lot of the issues that they raised are really what I call serious, substantial issues that demand some sort of a policy response or at least a further policy examination. Like the Sonos guy had seemed like his primary issue, aside from, you know, the intellectual property spat that he's got going on with Google, which we'll talk about later. But he wants to put virtual assistants in the Sonos smart speakers, which, you know, makes perfect sense, right?
Yeah.
Only because that market right now is kind of mixed up. He wants to be able to have multiple virtual assistants in the device. So like a Google Home and an Alexa, which is technically doable. And in fact, we know it's so doable that the companies and Apple and three or four other companies that are into home automation have decided to standardize an API.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So,
and then I select Cortana or Bixby.
Mm-hmm. That you'd have some kind of meta, you know, there'd be some kind of meta level of control where it'd be like, which one do you want to talk to now? Or maybe you want to talk to all of them, or, you know, maybe when you're...
You could have them race.
When you're in a certain room, maybe, you know, I mean, that part's easy.
That's actually fascinating. Mm-hmm. I've made my Siri sound like an Australian male, and he sounds precious, but he's not very smart.
Yeah, I would think it'd make it dumber. Yeah.
But Siri, I'm liking her. I don't use Google Home, but I have friends who do, and they really like it. I actually saw the Google Home booth out at CES, and they had some really interesting things. One of them is that you could ask Google Home to forget everything that you said that week. And I thought, wouldn't that be cool if you could actually do that in real life?
If you could say that to, like, people?
Yeah, you could just say to time itself, forget everything I said this last week, and it would just dissolve. Apparently, you can do that with Google Home. I'll look it up.
I think that would be pretty amazing.
I digress. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Go back to the smart guy.
Yeah, so he wants to put, Google Home and Alexa and his speakers, and Google says, well, if you do that, you can't use our stuff. The only way we'll do business with you is if we have an exclusive on your Sonos speakers.
So is that saying to Sonos, you can, because I do have two Alexa enabled Sonos, but I think I chose that, but it was a couple years ago, or I could choose Google, but I can't have both. Is that what they're saying?
No, he's saying that you, if, if you want to have any level of Google Home support at all in your product line, there can be no support for Alexa at all in your product line.
Huh. Well, I guess that is making a choice of one.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and I think for in his position, obviously the sensible choice is, thank you, Google, I'm going with Alexa. Because, you know, they got a much bigger footprint, bigger market share, more widely supported. So it seems like Google's kind of shooting themselves in the foot, you know, with that stance that where they are, they'd be better off being more accommodating.
Yeah, I mean, because you might accidentally switch over to one and find it that it works. But once you've, you know, like a lot of things, once you've committed to an ecosystem, you like to stick in it because it's where your world resolves. It says the Apple girl that's on the phone here.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I do. But I mean, Siri is not really.
True.
You can't really do home automation with Siri. It's just not there. It's not supported in enough devices.
And I'm pretty impressed with Alexa.
Yeah, I mean,
things she doesn't get, but she's 99% there.
Yeah, and I think it is, you know, I have some Google Home devices, but I don't use them.
Well, that's not a good testament.
Yeah, I mean, and I've learned how to program them and set them up, and I've got all this, I've got some motion sensors now that turn lights on in dark rooms and things like that, but it's just, you know, you learn how to program in one ecosystem, then, you know, that skill, you want to just use that to the extent that you can, and it's not substantially different, you know, from one to the other. If anything, I think Alexa's easier to program than Google Home is.
Interesting. I just talked to her. I haven't tried to program her, but I'm glad to hear that from an expert. So I found what they had at the Google booth that said, it's built to keep your information private, safe, and secure. Easy to use privacy controls. Just ask your assistant to delete what you said or everything you said this week. So I guess that means just specifically to the device, which is curious to know that they're holding on to all that metadata.
Huh. I imagine they would. I mean, it's the, while I was driving to Boulder, there was an interview on the radio I was listening to about California politics, and somebody quoted the governor who said recently that when it comes to transportation, everybody wants to have good roads and no traffic, but they don't want to pay for it.
That's not true. Every time I send a quarterly check to the IRS, I thank them for the infrastructure because it makes me feel better about sending them money.
Yeah, but that's not really how it gets paid for, is it?
Oh, come on. Don't ruin it for me.
Yeah, and he was talking about the fact that there are a couple of ballot measures in Colorado that were about essentially raising some taxes to pay for better highway infrastructure. And they both failed. But voters are still complaining that the highway infrastructure sucks. But, you know, like what's a governor supposed to do? When citizens said, we can't spend money on this, and, you know, but people want better roads. And it's like, they don't have a magic wand.
It's one of those things you have to plan it a bit forward. It's good to have a long tail plan, especially on infrastructure, physical or networking.
Yeah. And one of these witnesses actually said, I think it was, I don't want to misattribute this remark, but one of them said that they think behavioral advertising, or what he called targeted advertising, is inherently evil. And there should be we should just stop companies from collecting data to use for behavioral advertising, period. It's full stop, end of story. And I'm thinking, whoa, I mean, I understand that, you know, people are concerned about the creepiness factor of having a lot of their personal behavior captured and, you know, fed into algorithms and crunched up to, you know, produce these just to determine what ads we see. But it also does a lot of other things. I mean, the ability to collect that data and crunch it enables traffic planners to figure out where the capacity needs to be added to the highway system, right? If they can get location data from people while they're commuting, they can figure things like that out. So instead of spending all money equally on all the highways, whether they're congested or not, they spend it on the congested ones first, which is, you know, what we want, especially when we're fiscally, you know, prudent or miserly, like most of us are. So I think that, yeah, that was that went too far.
Well, there's a lot of interesting ideas out there right now.
Another one had a complaint that the fees that they have to pay to Apple to be in the App Store are too high. It's like a 30% cut. But of course, the flip side of that is that developers make more money from the Apple App Store than they make from the various Android stores, some of which are completely free.
Interesting.
In terms of, I mean, there's no markup.
Right, because they've taken the time to curate it, and yes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so these trade-offs are a bit, I mean, and these are the people who are in the business, they're building these products, and they should know better. But, you know, it's some of this stuff is starting to look a bit like a witch hunt.
True. So you wrote a blog this week that explained quite a bit about the Sonos, I guess they're being sued by Google? Or they're suing Google? Sorry.
Yes, Sonos, it was about some... Really, it was mostly about Google, and part of that was about the intellectual property, the patent suit that Sonos has filed against Google. The long and short of it is that Google and Sonos worked together really closely back in 2013 to make the Sonos speaker work with Google's first music service. It's called Google Play Music, a service that no longer exists, but they shared a lot of proprietary info. Sonos shared a lot of proprietary info with Google so that they could make some tweaks to the service so that it would get the most out of the Sonos speakers, which, you know, it's an incredibly sophisticated device. The thing that Sonos is doing where, you know, you can have stereo speakers that are synchronized with each other and they're both taking a music stream via Wi-Fi and playing it out with something that's pretty close to the fidelity you'd get from a wired, you know, hi-fi system. I used to work in that area developing patents and intellectual property for Sharp Labs that related to that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that is really difficult stuff to do. But Sonos figured it out. And, you know, for a long time, they had that market all to themselves. But lo and behold, Google started including Sonos technology into follow-on devices to the Google Play Music, you know, such as Chromecast Audio, Google Home, and Android. And they never, you know, they still don't have a patent agreement, a licensing agreement with Sonos to compensate Sonos for the use of this very important, you know, intellectual property.
So Sonos and Google were collaborating.
Mm-hmm.
And Google walked away with the technology under arm, but they didn't have an agreement
right
on how it was going to be used.
Right. Huh. And so they've been in, you know, having discussions for probably 6 or 7 years about licensing, and, you know, they haven't come to an agreement on anything. I mean, they want, you know, Google doesn't want to pay the fee that they want to collect. And of course, as long as Google is able to use their technology for free, they're not exactly highly motivated to settle, right?
Right. I mean, it is interesting how, you know, the Sonos facilitates, you know, and I use mine on Alexa, but, you know, I can use multiple different streaming services on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great. So people love it. I mean, I don't ask it to do all the other things. Everybody tells me that their kids love to have it play songs. I mean, there's, or it turned off the lights, and I'm like, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Wonder about the laziness of what's going to happen there, but it does a lot of interesting stuff.
Well, and it's nice to be able, if you know, to speak to your virtual home assistant, tell it what playlist you want, right? To do, and that, I take it, that's not really a direct voice control is not a capability that Sonos comes with out of the box, you know, because they're focus was on replacing the speakers. And so it's kind of a one-way system, like you control it from your phone or you control it from your computer, but you don't necessarily talk to it.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about the things I saw at CES, and I was just wondering about the licensing agreement. I know that Amazon had a whole room full of devices. Basically, there were a lot of sound bars, but it was CES. Mm-hmm. So we were looking at it. But there's also a new Alexa, it's kind of like a mushroom. That is supposed to be, you know, kind of a replacement, a pretty good quality service. So, yeah, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, every iteration, they improve the hi-fi quite a bit, you know. So
That's, and then the fact that Google's not having to pay anything, I can certainly see your point. They're not going to come to the table probably anytime soon. But that's part of the frightening part of being in the business where Google can come just in and eat you.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, and they're not just doing this to small companies. I mean, they have another intellectual property spat going on with Oracle over Java.
Yeah, that's been going on for a long time.
Yeah, it's been going on, yeah, almost forever. And it dates back to, I think, probably about to 2007 or so. And the very first, you know, after Google realized that they were losing market share in search, as companies moved to mobile, and they paid lots of money to Mozilla Foundation to be the primary, the default search service on Firefox.
Mm-hmm.
And so that enabled them to, you know, just without having to do anything, they end up getting all the searches from people that use Firefox on both mobile devices and desktops. But
so even though you think you're using Firefox, Google is on the back end on that. They're actually the search engine.
Well, yeah, I mean, but people know that, right?
I guess so. It used to be Yahoo a long time ago. I guess I was.
Oh yeah, it's not really obvious, I guess, if you just take it out of the box and just start using it.
Yeah.
Because they have that one input bar that's both for URLs and for search queries. So, yeah, you probably most people don't realize that it's going to Google, and you can
change
it.
They think they're going to Firefox as an alternative.
Yeah, and they think and they're probably right that Firefox is a little better on respecting privacy than Chrome is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think Chrome, it's like every Chrome browser has a hard wire to, you know, Google headquarters.
I'm pretty sure it sucks everything out of my brain, but it works to my advantage, at least for the time being.
So there's that. And, but you know, the thing about Java is that when Oracle bought Sun Microsystems and Java came with it, and they licensed it under GPL, which is the same, it's the general programming license that is used by the Linux kernel and by all the GNU programming tools like Emacs and C compilers and all that. And it's a pretty permissive license in the sense that, you know, anybody can use the stuff and put it in any kind of money-making system you want. And you don't have to pay any money. And the only thing they ask of you is that you give them attribution. And if you make any modifications to the code that you roll into your product that you ship that's based on GPL software like the Linux kernel, that you contribute those enhancements for free back to the community so that other people can use them.
Ah, yeah.
And so it's kind of a share and share alike, you know, ethos, like a bunch of people who weren't compensated by, you know, the Free Software Foundation, but probably by other employers, contributed the code that makes Linux work, and everybody shares it. And every time somebody improves it, then they have to check in their improvements, and the community can decide whether they want to roll that into the standard distribution or not, or maybe into some fork. I mean, maybe you make some special real-time enhancement and they put it in that fork, but that's the thing. And the thing that Oracle is concerned about is that, well, what Google did is they took an open source version of Java from basically a now defunct open source project that used a different license, used the Apache license, where people can make enhancements and then they don't have to share them back with the community. And so it's okay for them to mix their modified code with unmodified code that comes from the open source distribution if they want to. And so basically Google says, no, we don't want to share it under your terms. You want to share it under our terms. And if you don't agree with us, well, too bad. We'll just steal 13,000 lines of your code and put it in our product and not pay you a nickel. Ha, ha, ha. And that's where they are. So the, you know, Oracle sued them for patent violation and also for copyright because it was some software that ended up, you know, being the critical thing. Google prevailed on the patent claims, but Oracle prevailed on the copyright claims, at least as far as the federal circuit, and Google wasn't happy with that, so they've appealed it to the Supreme Court twice. And first time the Supreme Court told them to pound sand, the second time they said, come on down. And so that case is going to be heard, shortly, probably within the next month or two. We'll see how it goes. But it's, because it's about software and it's about APIs and it's about interpreted code and it's about licensing terms, it's a wonderful opportunity for companies to create very thick smoke screens around the actual issues.
Yeah, that one's been going on for a long time, but you feel like that's the titans of industry fighting the titans of industry. You worry about some of these smaller guys. It sounds like these are the people that you were hearing from today at the congressional hearing that just don't have the wherewithal to let it go on for years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was actually kind of funny because one of the witnesses was talking about how he feels like he's being so badly treated by Amazon that he'd really like to sue them. But he's not sure that, suing, that he can afford to sue Amazon. And so he's sitting right next to the Sonos guy.
Uh-huh.
And the Sonos guy also has a beef with Amazon, but he only sued Google because he can't afford to sue them both at the same time.
Faustian choice.
Yeah, kind of funny. I don't know if they're the second party of the first part was aware of the position of the party of the second part. But yeah, it was that kind of stuff is hilarious.
Then you also mentioned in your blog post after the talking about the Java licensing situation that YouTube uses piracy for leverage. I thought this was a really interesting point about the, after Google copied thousands of lines of Oracle code, the federal circuit court, you thought would prevail, but Google has done something interesting. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, it's pretty much all along. YouTube is the number one platform for people watching music videos now.
I wouldn't even know where to go. Otherwise, that's oddly true.
Yeah, I mean, MTV hadn't done any music videos for a long time.
So I do miss them, though.
Yeah, I want my MTV. So yeah, I was looking at some figures on the payout rates of the different streaming services to artists, which is compiled by the various people who study this, and there's a link to the study in the blog post. And come to find out that the highest payouts are from a company called Napster, that's the name of that old piracy service.
Yep.
But it's actually Pandora. I mean, the Pandora company bought the name and they think it's a cute name, so they're using it.
That's nice. Historic point.
They actually pay 25 times as much to artists as YouTube does. So it's like 1.7 cents per play versus on Napster. 0.07.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So 0.007 of a cent. How many times does somebody have to listen to your song for you to be able to pay a week's rent? I mean, that's
a lot.
Yeah. And their licensing deal with artists is like, take it or leave it. This is what we'll pay you. And if it's not enough for you, then fine. We just won't license your work. But they know that if they say no to YouTube, pirates are just going to upload their music anyway.
Right.
And, what motivation does YouTube really have to remove pirated music that they don't have otherwise on their platform?
Plus, they're making money on the sidebar where they're running ads against.
Yeah, and they don't even have to share that 0.007 with anybody. They just keep, the whole 2 pennies or whatever it is. Yeah, and apparently there's one of the complaints I heard at the hearing was about a similar problem with ads and search ads. That the guy's complaint was that Google is no longer a search service; it's an ad service. So you search for his company's name, and the first thing you'll find is like five or so ads that were bought from the Google auction that have his company's name as a keyword.
I had that happen the other day. I was looking for FedEx because I specifically needed to go find out where to get this FedEx package, and the only first thing came up was UPS. I didn't look at it. I clicked on it, and I realized I was on the wrong website.
Yeah, And so it's this is this kind of conflict of interest thing that people complain about with platforms, that you know, what's good for the platform isn't necessarily good for the consumer. And in cases where these platforms are dominant and there's not really competition is not going to rein them in, then you know, what's the consumer to do?
Yeah, what I know they made an announcement about cookies. They're going to be phasing out cookies in the next 2 years. That seems to go in their favor somehow too.
Well, if they phase out cookies, they'll probably replace them with something that's more informative and more sticky, right?
Well, somehow it seemed like the cookies were probably going to benefit other people because you buy the cookie information, where Google will still keep sucking up your information, but somehow they won't call it cookies. I don't know. I haven't delved into it yet. I'll be fascinated to figure out how they've manhandled that.
Yeah, I mean, cookies always has been kind of a kludge, right? It's the, why would, if I'm building a database of your behavior, I don't want to store that on your computer. I want to store it on my computer.
Right.
And whenever I, you know, when I write that cookie into your browser, yeah, then anybody else can see that cookie. But I mean, depending, but other people can see it.
I would think that the capture of the information there, they're trying to keep more exclusive and getting rid of cookies.
Yeah. And so it's kind of like, I'll just grab your data without leaving a trace.
Yeah.
I mean, and you know, burglars have been doing that for a long time. That works great. So it's, you know, these are unique problems, because I think there's obviously a reason that the big five dominant, you know, internet edge companies, which is Google, Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, and Amazon, they didn't get to be as big as they are without providing something of value to consumers. I brought this up in a question to Chairman Cicilline after the hearing. Here's what he said. So 10 years ago, the five major dominant platforms in today's economy were not, with the exception of Microsoft, they were small companies that nobody was really worried about. So it seems that the progression that's taken place over the last 10 years allowed those companies to go from being very competitive, very innovative startups to these sort of abusive monsters that we have today. Did somebody take their eye off the ball?
Well, I mean, I think the reality is, I think when these companies emerged, these large technology platforms, you know, there was a lot of pride. These were great American companies. They are great American companies. They were growing. They were creating jobs. It was exciting for people. You could get products delivered to your house the next day. You could connect grandmothers to their grandchildren overseas. And there was like a lot of exciting stuff happening. And I think we didn't fully appreciate the implications of this kind of market consolidation and market power. And I think it was Republicans and Democrats. I mean, I think there hasn't been a robust antitrust enforcement effort in this country in a very long time. And I think, you know, as a result of a number of things, maybe most significantly the Cambridge Analytica scandal, I think people started to realize
this was a wake-up call.
And so I think, you know, it was Republicans and Democrats. There wasn't a lot of antitrust enforcement. I think people's attitude was like, stay out of the way and just let it flourish. Mm-hmm. I think the Europeans were ahead of us in some respects in sort of understanding the implications on consumers and privacy and the markets and discriminatory behavior from the size of these companies. And we're sort of trying to catch up. But I think the good news is there's broad consensus from Republicans and Democrats that we've got to get this right.
Interesting, right?
That's true. I mean, there's a reason why you tend to want to use their services. First of all, they work.
Yeah.
They're not as clunky. They're interoperable for a lot of reasons. But as you make a point also in your blog, that sometimes the interoperability becomes, you know, it's easy for Google to kind of grab into everybody else's market, but it's hard to get strangleholded by Google being the one that you have to go through to get what you want off the interwebs.
And, you know, when I hear people complaining about Huawei, I'm kind of struck by the fact that, you know, you could pretty much say all the same things about Google. I mean, other than working for the Chinese military.
That's what I was going to ask. Are they working for the Chinese government?
Well, I mean, they probably would, right? Now, I don't think the employees would go for it, but certainly, you know, because Google employees don't even want them working for the American military.
Yeah. Interesting. A bit, yeah. They don't want to be working with the American military, but they're okay with selling information on certain devices to China. They got to work on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a lot of that is just that people don't understand how this stuff works, do they?
That's forever seems to be.
So, yeah, it's kind of hard to regulate a market until you understand the dynamics of the market. Well, and one thing I found interesting, given that this is an antitrust hearing, there was absolutely zero mention of economics.
Oh.
And, you know, it may be that 30% cut that Apple takes is the Pareto efficient, you know, benchmark, and it's actually best for everybody if that's what it is. But, I mean, and there's some sort of argument probably to be made for that. But
economics is a pretty core element to antitrust. Thinking really old school there?
Yeah, you are. You're definitely... I think that's the first tenet of hipster economics or hipster antitrust, is that you have to throw out the math. And it's really like, how does this dominant firm make me feel?
Yeah. It makes me feel icky.
Does it affirm my self-esteem? Does it really validate my my view of myself, you know? I mean, no, it's just sort of, yeah, cause you know, I'm sure that when that was before it was normal for antitrust regulators to look at these things mathematically. There were some pretty bizarre decisions that were made. If it's just simply the metric is big as bad, then yeah, that's not going to lead to good outcomes. Certainly not, you know, not in the long run.
So I'm fascinated because we've been having this hipster antitrust conversation for a couple years now, that Google seems to just keep going like the headstrong into it.
Well, I think Google is pretty confident in their ability to influence the Federal Trade Commission.
Hmm.
I mean, I get into some of that in the blog about the sort of revolving doors between.
You mentioned 320 Googlers moved between company and the U.S. government during the Obama administration. I knew there were quite a few of them, but they were nice people. But I didn't realize the number was that high.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's counting movements in both directions. I mean, some of those people are government employees first.
They
went the other way. But I think it kind of amounts to the same thing in a lot of cases. But yeah, I mean, and that's a bit disturbing. There's some number of techies that we want to have involved in you know, working in government agencies and helping with the analysis. And those people are probably going to have worked for some company at some point in their lives. So
no, there's certain governments, and ours, except for Google was the exception, are actually see the benefit of people going in between industry back to government with the idea of making possibly the regulatory process more efficient. Mm-hmm. And I can see a value to that as long as there's not capture, which is the challenge. But yeah, I do think that they gave Google a wide berth during the last 10 years.
Well, I think it's okay to have the Google people going to work for government as long as, you know, some Google competitors and people from companies that have maybe different economic interests, that as long as they're doing the same thing, right? So it's not just Google as this one and only tech perspective, because they clearly aren't. They have a set of interests that are unique to their business model. And their business model may itself be problematic just in its own right.
I mean, I have to admit, I use a lot of their products, and I can certainly see, you know, they've got a lot of money to get into everything, but I always like reading their 10K.
Yeah, so our friend Tom Hazlett had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal within the last week or so about regulators worry too much about antitrust when the effects of dominant firms tend to be transitory. So he was telling the easiest story you can tell to make that case, which is the AOL Time Warner merger.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it could also be the case that, and I think that is generally true, that, you know, historically there have been a whole lot of dominant firms that ceased to be dominant at some point. People don't worry about IBM anymore. And IBM, you know, pioneered a whole lot of these kind of abusive practices that Google is engaging in now. But we don't worry about IBM, and we don't even worry about Microsoft. And once upon a time, it seemed like Microsoft had an insurmountable advantage. So, but, you know, the iPhone just bypassed it. So like, yeah, keep your desktop. That's fine. I'll be in the guy's hand. So,
right.
Yeah, who wins? But yeah, I don't know. I mean, at some point, I think it's at least an intellectual possibility that a company achieves a degree of pervasiveness in the economy and a degree of power and concentration and influence, including, you know, the power to influence not only policymakers, but also The people who generate ideas, which is to say the think tanks and academic programs and all that, where it's just like kudzu. I mean, it just grows everywhere and there's no way to get rid of it.
Did they bring up data portability in today's hearing?
No, that didn't come up.
Okay. So after hearing from Sonos, PopSocket, Basecamp, and Tile, was there any kind of conclusion, or was this just hearing of the witnesses?
Well, after the hearing was over, I was part of the little press gaggle that was around Chairman Cicilline. And he did say that they were going to have some further hearings and that they recognize they do need to hear the perspectives of the big companies who are the presumed targets of antitrust action. And I think when those guys come in, and of course he wants to talk to the CEOs and the big decision makers, I want to really see, let them come in, make their case. But, you know, to me, the real question is really going to come down to the business model. Some of that is tech, some of it is economics. But let's learn more about the business models and apply the economic model as well as we can. If we find shortcomings in the economic model that are maybe technical in nature, then we can start working on that. One thing that I did not do in this blog post was give advice to Congress about how to solve the problem.
Do you have a solution?
No, I don't.
I don't even
feel comfortable defining the problem. And I don't think anyone else is really giving crisp definitions of it either. But sometimes that's the key to coming up with a solution, is that you have to identify a problem that actually can be solved. One of the things that was striking about this hearing was that it actually was held in the room where the idea of net neutrality was first shared with the world.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was at a Silicon Flatirons conference back in 2003, where in this very room, it's the Whittemeyer Courtroom at CU Boulder, where Tim Wu presented his paper. And the idea of net neutrality, you know, became a policy issue. And people like to complain that in the 17 years since then, you know, Congress hadn't done anything about it. But in fact, they did the most important thing, which is they defined what net neutrality means in regulatory terms, that it's the ban on blocking, throttling, and paid prioritization. Those three elements are we all know now, when we talk about net neutrality regulations in the United States, we're talking about those three things. And that concrete manifestation and definition of net neutrality enabled at least the conversation to take off and to get to a point where we understood, you know, we could look at the particular trade-offs. And so the trade-offs are all in the loopholes to those three bands. And of course, the shortcoming is that that's strictly a negative definition. So it doesn't tell us what state of affairs we're trying to achieve with net neutrality. But my point is, to make a long story even longer, you know, defining the problem would get us that next step is we have to collect enough information, do enough analysis, that we can actually define the problem we're trying to solve. And yeah, that problem better not be some companies are really big.
I mean, sometimes big works. It's, you know, there's economy of scale there. It's just a matter of, are they taking advantage of it to the detriment of the consumer, which is why we have a Federal Trade Commission.
Well, and, you know, guess what? Like 10 years ago, these five dominant internet companies, well, with the exception of Microsoft, the other four weren't dominant.
Right. I mean, Amazon used to be about books, and I still do order books from Amazon, but I order a lot of other things too.
Mm-hmm. And Apple was kind of a quirky little, you know, music player company, right?
Yeah.
And Google was on, well, because it's search. It's like, you know, better than Alta Vista. Thank you. And faster. And that was it. Right. And so nobody was scared of those companies. But, you know, so what happened over the course of the last 10 years that transformed them from, you know, sort of cuddly little teddy bears into, you know, the monster that's going to eat your children? That's what we need to understand that better.
Well, I think the information vacuuming, I think you might have said that at some point. I like that phrase, you know, where they just keep sucking up all this data and we keep giving it to them because we don't know how not to. It's part of the you know, the data processing that we're looking at and what some people call privacy. you know, how do we get around that? Or how do we figure out that it can be monetized and we have some control over it? That's obviously a part of the challenge, which isn't really an antitrust issue, but it's part of the, you know, what tech has put forward. I would say part of the challenge is we've made things so plug and play that people just don't understand how it works. They just like that it does until it doesn't.
I mean, I like the formula framing you put on this in one of our previous discussions, where you said that you thought the issue was actually data security.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, collect whatever you want, but whatever you collect, you better be able to protect it.
Yep. There was a piece that came out of Europe this morning. If somebody really took the time to detail how much information they were able to get off of one particular website. Unfortunately, it was a porn website, but then they even said to that point, they had the pictures of the licenses that the one country, you know, insisted the models, as they called them, were, but you know, how much information that even put them in jeopardy. And so people don't always understand how, you know, giving away all this information is getting collected by someone for not always a net positive effect.
Yeah. And I would think that it's so easy to collect data. It's a lot easier to collect it than it is to protect it from hackers, right?
Yes. And that, and I was also reading another article this morning about how, you know, as I've seen it several times, CCPA, the California privacy legislation that passed, it went into effect.
Yeah, January. Nobody knows what it means.
Well, there's that, but it's also this one person decided to test it and to see what it took to get out of, you know, saying, yes, I'd like you to not collect my information. And they had to send in even more information, including a copy of their driver's license, to then try to not have them. So it's just this kind of awkward situation where you're like, I don't trust you, but now I need to give you more information so you can have no information on me. It seems like we need to work with the technology, not against it, if we're going to try to make that a valid way of, I mean, I can understand people not wanting their information being collected, but therefore they should not have to have them collect more information.
Well, this is I spent about 10 years hanging around the California legislature. This is more common than you might think.
We're seeing that with the way that they're treating part-time workers too. It's interesting.
Yeah. Sometimes it's just best to do nothing.
Well, thanks for putting your collective thoughts together. I think your blog was really an interesting read. I hope that our listeners take the time to go take a look at it. There's a lot of good stuff on the High Tech Forum website, as always. But
yeah, I kind of like it.
Yeah, but this is a very current piece, and knowing that, you know, not if we're having field hearings, we'll be back to having regular hearings here in Washington as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really all that surprising that folks in Washington would want to be in Boulder on the Friday before a 3-day weekend in the winter.
Oh, do you all have snow right now?
Well, we always have snow.
Yes, you do. All right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, it's good talking. And as always, and will folks, we do these things at least once a month, sometimes more frequently, on hightechforum.org. And the podcasts are available on all the usual sources. And as everyone else it does in the entire world, we appreciate your feedback, your commentary, and share with a friend. So once again, Shane, thanks for joining us, and I'm Richard Bennett, your host of the High Tech Forum podcast. Signing off.